It's a real treat to be here. In large part because I think there may be among you all a solution to a set of problems that the people I'm going to talk about today had culturally and didn't figure out a solution to. And it's an interesting problem. And I've been trying to think about what to talk about today and how to sort of keep it focused. I want to do a couple of different things. I want to simply tell you sort of what the book's about and give you kind of a synopsis of what's in here, partly with an entirely self-serving eye to encouraging you to read it. But beyond that, I want to open up particular passages in this story, the passages around the 40s, 50s, and the 60s, which are passages that are bits of cultural history that really, I think, shape what we're doing today in ways that then might allow us to reflect a little bit on sort of how to go forward from here in terms of cultural activism around the net. So that's a little bit what I'd like to do. And I'd like to start then, I think I'll talk probably for 20, 25 minutes, and then we can go straight to Q&A. Does that fit the norms pretty much? Here, okay, great. So that's what I'll do. I'm really looking forward to the Q&A. I want to kind of give everybody enough to hang on to for the Q&A and then go forward from there. So I'm going to stand up because I'm too nervous to sit, and it's going to make me happier. Okay, so a little bit about my background. I was a journalist in Boston for 10 years, back in the 80s and into the early 90s. I worked for the Boston Globe magazine. I wrote for the Sunday magazine. I wrote for the Boston Phoenix mostly, and then some papers down in Providence. Toward the end of that period, I was getting frustrated with journalism for a variety of reasons. A particular thing happened. I was covering the Chinese students in America during Tiananmen, 1989, and I had the sensation that I was covering a social event that had very deep historical roots, but I had absolutely no forum for addressing that. I was filing 750, 1,000-word stories, you know, twice a day, on things that were happening, and I was kind of constantly in touch with what was happening, but I had no language for the longer, deeper, slower stuff. So I thought I needed to slow down, and I wrote a book. I wrote a book about how Americans remember the Vietnam War. And that ultimately led me back to graduate school and onward. Why that matters here is that in the course of writing that book, I entered a time in which computers were emblems of the Cold War military state. In 1964, students who marched for free speech at Berkeley actually hung Hollerith cards around their necks. They hung computer cards around their necks. I'll show you a picture of it. To show that they did not want to be treated like information. They punched holes in the cards saying FSM, free speech movement. They hung signs around their chest, big ones, that said, I am a human being, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. Do not treat me like a computer. Do not treat me like information. So I wrote this book, and the book was mostly about trauma and cultural memory. I went in 1996 to graduate school at the University of California, San Diego, having realized that I was slowly morphing into a professor, and I accepted the change. Very dark. You know, but my friends around here are still a little bit like, yeah, Fred, we're happy for you. You know? But my mom's real excited. My mom's really thrilled. You know, I have a steady job now, and that's really good. So I go to California in 1996, having just finished this book, and suddenly I find a really different world. Suddenly I find things like Wired magazine promoting computing as a countercultural activity, computing as a way to engage in liberation. I was completely shocked. I mean, I spent, you know, years thinking about Vietnam, and suddenly here's Wired magazine with a daisy in its mouth. What's the daisy? Well, the last time I had thought about a daisy, it was in a picture from a 1967 march on the Pentagon, when that beautiful long-haired boy slips the daisy into the barrel of the National Guardsman's gun. But now, we're not fighting the government. We're cypherpunks. We're plotting world liberation with our computers. And we're fighting for the new economy? A treasury. I mean, this is really odd. This is sort of, you know, very 60s look to this. You can see sort of the bright psychedelic colors. You can see that this is a digitized globe. The smiley face is this weird sort of fusion of LSD and ecstasy, sort of saying, you know, well, we're all one rave culture together, and computers are going to free us up. Okay, to someone who has just spent, you know, 5 years locked in a room with books about Vietnam, and I'd spent 3 years interviewing combat vets, thinking about that time and thinking about computing in that time, this was a real surprise. And I started trying to figure out, how was it that a machine that had once been seen as the quintessential tool and emblem of the Cold War military-industrial state had instead now, over just 30 years, become a tool for cultural liberation? So the project is really a project about how the machine got defined. People who study computing and people who study other technologies have said for a long time that, every time a new technology gets introduced, democratic fantasies get attached to that technology. And that's actually true. Airplanes come along, people suddenly imagine America united by the airplane. Telephone likewise. Electricity is a little more complicated, but it too has a story there. Yet those stories tend to leave behind the question of how that happens. How are cultural hopes for democratic change articulated with and attached to new machines as they emerge? Likewise, in the 1990s, there was a group of critics, mostly on the left, who argued that a new class had emerged. Most of us would be members of that class. Richard Florida calls them the creatives. Other people call them other things. But it would be a class of knowledge workers, information professionals, people who make their living using, making, distributing information technology. And folks on the left argued that they needed a new ideology, and that in fact, was the source of Wired magazine. Well, there's an element of truth to that, too. Certainly, Wired magazine was, in its first 5 years, was a deeply libertarian sort of organ. But that obscures, again, that same question. How is it, and who's doing the work of linking machines to this liberating ideology? And why this ideology in particular? What is this thing? So I started digging around in the pages of Wired, and I started doing what reporters do. I started following the people. So here's Wired magazine, founded in 1993, just a couple of years after the internet goes public. Still running today, but the original staff that founded it was largely gone by 1998. So my book actually ends in 1998. Wired magazine includes not only interviews with Newt Gingrich, in which he's depicted as wildly hip, or George Gilder, promoter of stock disasters, with his hair flying back in a psychedelic pose. It's worth thumbing through the old issues. I started poking around, and I noticed that the contributors to Wired magazine and the story ideas for Wired magazine were almost entirely drawn from three organizations. And those three organizations were linked together. One was the Global Business Network, a consulting firm that's now part of the Monitor Group, founded in 1989 by Stuart Brand and a group of former Shell Oil people and people from Stanford Research Institute, SRI. Another was The Well, the Whole Earth Electronic Link, the first place at which the words virtual community were used on a regular basis. And I continue to get a lot of emails saying, well, no, our community used it earlier. I have yet to actually see any evidence of that. In any case, I'm open to cases if there are earlier cases that you know. Howard Rheingold, famous member of The Well, was actually the first person to use the term virtual community in print. He used it in 1987, and he used it in an article in the Whole Earth Review. The Whole Earth Review was a quarterly magazine, just went out of business again about 2 years ago. And it grew in turn out of a quarterly magazine called Coevolution Quarterly. Coevolution Quarterly, in turn, grew out of supplemental publications to the Whole Earth Catalog. And that's what I want to talk a lot about today. I want to talk about the Whole Earth Catalog. This is, in fact, a copy of the last Whole Earth Catalog. It's my pass-around copy. Don't worry, you can get food stains on it. Doesn't matter. It'll give you a feel for what the thing is. Have a look at the statement in the front where they say, "We are as gods. We might as well get good at it." Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Whole Earth Catalog. Before I go directly to the catalog, though, what I want to note is there's a network of people here who have been together for 30-plus years. They're enormously powerful. They're enormously influential. But they don't fit any of our categories of influence. So for the sociologists in the room, the book has a theory of social power. And I won't go into that too much today unless we get to it in Q&A. But it's a theory that I'm fairly proud of. And it's a theory that argues that people like Stuart Brand are Barnums, you know, like P.T. Barnum, the circus guy. They can't fly on trapezes, they can't ride horses, but what they can do is they can put rings around experience. They can invite different players into those rings. And they become the voice of the circus. And they gain the power to speak for the circus. And so throughout his career, at Wired, at the Global Business Network, at The Well, Brand has brought together diverse social networks, gathered them to talk together about something or to do something together, watch them develop contact languages for doing that, and then himself become the voice of those languages elsewhere. So even though Brand himself never touched a computer between 84 and between 74 and 84, by 85, he was widely depicted as a guru of the computer revolution. Okay. One other thing I'll note, I'm passing quickly over some things. I do have a website, and I have papers there that are easy to download. It's just fredturner.stanford.edu, no www in front. Okay, so a lot of this stuff is in papers there, and I welcome your inquiry. Other thing to note, and this is the argument I want to make today and that I think is so important for members of this community, there's a set of core ideas that emerge here in the 60s that travel down through time, through three phases. The 60s and the collapse of the counterculture in the mid-1970s, on through the Reagan era and the dramatic transformation of manufacturing, particularly on the West Coast, into the libertarian 90s, and some, including me, might argue the libertarian aughts. And what I want to focus on today, what I hope will be our chief takeaway, is that set of core ideas. The one thing I want to make sure that we all leave with today is a set of what the dreams were that were circulating through the counterculture that still, I would argue, circulate through our thoughts about computing today. So that's the goal. So let's go back to the Whole Earth Catalog. The Whole Earth Catalog, can I just see it for a sec? I'll pass it right back. So this is the last version of the Whole Earth Catalog. It came out in 1972. The first version came out in 1968, and it was a catalog of tools. And I just get chills when I touch this. I mean, this is wild. Let's take a step. We can't put it together. It is together.
Ooh.
You know, this is a world built around that ooh. It's neat. But besides it's being built around that, it has a vision of tools and tool use that I think hovers around computing today. And that's why I want to go there. Here's something we don't tend to remember. We don't tend to remember that between 1966 and 1973 was the largest wave of communal activity in all of American history. Before 1966, there were something like 640 communes in American history, the whole history of the country. Between 66 and 73, estimates range from 2 million to 10 million Americans participating in communes, communal living. This matters because this is why the Whole Earth Catalog was formed. There's a commune ideology that's very powerful in this period that I want to tease out a little bit. And it's an ideology of tool use, of consciousness, and of community. I'll say it very quickly, and then I'll try to talk about where it comes from. Here's the idea. The idea is that people on communes, the people for whom Brand founded this Whole Earth Catalog, believe that if we can leave the mainstream military-industrial world and its very large technologies and its very hierarchical social order behind, we can build alternative communities around shared consciousness. We will just be the right kind of people together, and we won't need politics anymore. We won't need hierarchy. We'll just get our heads together, as the saying was at the time. Okay. So how do you get your head together? Well, in that time, you do things like take LSD. I just want to note that I love having a job where I get to like come to work and talk about acid. It's okay. You know? This is part we don't tell mom about. But it's good. So what about LSD is so important? One of the things that I did in writing this book was go back and look through Stuart Brand's diaries and other period documents. And when people drop acid in this period, it's a life-shattering experience. Whereas folks who may take drugs now may engage in sort of a more entertainment-oriented drug experience, in that period, it's one where you drop acid and your outer shell seems to fade away and you are able to connect with other people and to feel a kind of intimacy with them. Throughout the 1960s, people like Stuart Brand create a series of venues where this connection can be performed. The Trips Festival in 1966 was one. There were others. They're chronicled in the book at great length. The Grateful Dead is the house band of this kind of experience and has made a career on that ever since. People gather together, form temporary communities around shared consciousness created by tools. Okay, there's an idea about technology in here that's really important and that lingers for us. And the challenge that Stuart Brand faced in this period that I think is somewhat analogous to ours is something like this. Imagine that you're growing up in the 1950s. Technology, on the one hand, is something that threatens to destroy the world. Nuclear weapons are about, the Soviet Union is shooting Sputnik up in 57. People are terrified that the world is literally about to end. Stuart Brand, whose diaries for that period I read, was a college student then, and he wrote page after page about what he would do when the Russians came to Stanford. I mean, it's like, huh? But he was dead serious. They were having undergraduate seminars on how to handle the Soviet menace. He really and truly believed that the Soviets were coming to Palo Alto, and he was talking about how he would handle it when they did. So he and others of his generation were utterly terrified that the world would end, and the technology and the kinds of mostly men who were bringing about that technology in their hierarchical world would create that problem. But here's the flip side. Flip side, Stuart Brand and others of his generation are living in an era of the greatest consumer technological wealth of all time. So the same military-industrial infrastructure that's bringing us nuclear weapons is also bringing us stereos, it's bringing us automobiles, it's bringing us all kinds of new mobility and new interconnecting kinds of pleasures. It also brings us LSD via the Stanford Engineering Department. That's quite a good story sometime. We can talk about that another time. That's one of those stories we don't tell on campus. The point here is that Brand has a dilemma, and I think it's a dilemma that we share. On the one hand, technology is something that, deployed in certain hands, threatens to end the world. On the other hand, you don't want to give up all of that really cool experiential technology that's suddenly available from some of the same sources. And so what Brand and his generation do, this generation that I'm calling the new communalists, the people who start the commune movement, and is that they turn away from politics. They turn away from the new left. They distinguish themselves ferociously from the new left. They don't go marching against the war. They refuse to, many of them. And they go instead back to the land. And they say that we, with our small-scale technologies, will form communities of consciousness that can serve as functional alternatives to a mainstream world gone haywire. This turn has enormous consequences, and it's the consequences of this turn that are, in fact, the subject of my book. I want to give you one moment from the turn. 1966, Ken Kesey, leader of the Merry Pranksters, was invited to speak at an anti-war march. At this point, leaders of the new left, people like Todd Gitlin, leading the Students for a Democratic Society, were protesting the war very aggressively. They were getting ready to march on the Oakland Recruiting Center, the intake center, and they gathered, and they were really excited. It's like they begun to see that the new communalists were veering away. They were going to have Kesey up there on the stage, and he was going to speak, and that was going to bring the new communalists and the new left back together. Kesey got up on the stage and refused to speak. He pulled out his harmonica, and he played Home on the Range. And then he said to the group, "Don't march. That's what they do. Go home and build a better world." Okay. So what are the consequences of that move? Well, it's been really interesting. Stuart Brand took that injunction very seriously and started building better worlds. In 1984, he and Larry Brilliant co-founded The Well, the Whole Earth Electronic Link, arguably the first virtual community, or the first thing to think of itself as a virtual community, bringing with it a series of countercultural ideals that helped structure networked activity in the 1980s and 90s. But watch the trajectory here. The turn away from politics, the turn toward technologies of consciousness, is a turn that Newt Gingrich, when he comes on the scene, can embrace wholeheartedly. Newt Gingrich utterly rejects the hedonism of the 1960s. But he's right there with the idea that if we develop new technologies, we can escape the bureaucracy of government. We can liberate ourselves from industrial era bureaucratic regimes. Now, I'm truncating the argument very intensely. I can go on at length about any of these phases and would be happy to during Q&A. And my strategy in presenting today is simply to give you a floor from which we can have a conversation. I want to focus more on the conversation. But what I want to point to here is that in the 1960s, Stuart Brand and the new communalists turned away from politics and toward tools and culture as the way and site for doing politics. And when I go to the Berkman site and I see some of the work going on here, though much less than I see in other places, I see a similar turn, a turn toward tools and culture as sites for political action. In the Brand case, the turn from, from away from politics has had, I think, largely deleterious consequences. I think that it has made it possible for a networked style of power to emerge in which culture becomes the basis for collaboration and coherence. That's fine in some settings, but it's a real problem in others. So I'll say, for example, that Brand's world, like the communes and ever since, is an almost exclusively white world. It's an almost exclusively male world. I interviewed Stuart Brand's first wife, Lois. She said, yeah, we used to go out to the communes, and the men would go talk about important stuff while we put Clorox in the water to keep people from getting sick. The communes were one of the most gender-segregated, heteronormative worlds you ever hope to play in. And it was hysterical. We're going to escape this world, and yet we get out to the communes, and we replicate the suburbs. It's sort of astonishing. The network style of power that is characteristic of Brand's world, and that many folks who would turn away from bureaucracy, law, regulation toward, I would argue it has at times historically been a world in which cultural norms become the source of social cohesion. And that's okay if you've got the right cultural norms and the social capital to support them. It's a problem if you don't. So I have a little essay that I'm working on in the back of my head called In Defense of Bureaucracy. We can talk about that too. I'm taking a fairly hard line here, in part then to turn back and say one of the things that I really admired and sort of watching from a distance some of the things that are going on here is that I sense that there's an attempt here to do something that is not going on very much on the West Coast that I know about, and that is to integrate the amazing cultural opportunities that new technologies have brought us with social structures, institutional structures that are rule-bound in a classic sense, and to take some of the advantages that institutions have for making social change, and to use new technologies to leverage those and not turn away from that. I think that's really important. If I would argue for what a next step needs to be, it's a bridging of this classic American cultural historical gap between the new communalists and the new left, between those who do culture and those who do politics, between those who seek alternative techno-social worlds and those who seek to work in and build and change institutions. That's the fusion. That's where I think we need to go. And I think that's probably a good place to stop. If you'd like more about the counterculture, particular connections to particular parts of computing, I'm very happy to talk about that. This is the group that brought us the following terms as we understand them today: personal computer, virtual community, and the notion of cyberspace as an electronic frontier, as an optimistic place. This group of people brought us all three of those things, and I can tell the stories about how each of those things came to be. They're an enormously influential group, and this type of influence they have, I think, is becoming increasingly important in our world, and it both excites and scares me. So I think this is probably a good moment to throw it open.
Could you discuss the relationship between these guys and the guys in the garage? Steve Jobs and
absolutely
the Woz and so on.
Okay, so let's get really clear on Wozniak and Jobs. They are not counterculturalists and never have been. Jobs has relentlessly marketed his 1 year of wandering. It's sort of, think of it as his gap year. He has relentlessly marketed his gap year as a sign that Apple is in fact a countercultural company, even as Apple has locked down its code and done a series of things and worked its workers extraordinary hours, done a series of things that are anything but countercultural. And Woz has done a sort of similar thing. So the garage connection is an interesting one. The Homebrew Computer Club did include people who were regular readers of the Whole Earth catalog. Included some folks who were active in Whole Earth worlds, like Lee Felsenstein, who founded a series of early PC projects. But the technologies that were circulating in there and that were the sources of the machines that they built were, in fact, technologies that were developed in the Silicon Valley area for military purposes. Until 1972, virtually every chip in the valley was put into a Polaris missile. Now, people don't tend to remember that. I mean, that's deep military culture there. And Woz and Jobs and those guys had access to those technologies in part because they had relatives or friends who worked in those industries, and those things were circulating in the valley. A larger point I want to make is that we tend also to think of, and certainly Jobs and Wozniak and John Markoff from the New York Times have retailed this idea extensively, we tend to think that the idea that we should expand our consciousness is a countercultural idea that was then applied to PCs. That as we miniaturize PCs, we thought, wow, we can now expand our consciousness with these. It gets the story backwards. The idea that we needed to expand our consciousness is in fact a Cold War research story. We needed to grow our minds in the 1940s because if we didn't, we were going to get destroyed by Hitler. And we needed to expand our ability to see farther around the globe in the 1950s because if we didn't, the Soviets were going to send bombers and nukes our way. So the idea that we will expand our minds and see farther, extend our human capacities, is an idea that emerges and is deeply embedded within military research culture. It's an idea that Stuart Brand and the counterculturalists, particularly the new communalist wing of the counterculture, embrace and legitimate culturally. But it's not an idea that emerges in the counterculture. So one of the sections of my book is called, you know, The Counterculture That Wasn't. And I'll just give you a very small visual example of this phenomenon or some version of it. I'll take you to the Trips Festival in 1966, long heralded as one of the quintessential events of the counterculture, helped drive the rise of Haight-Ashbury as a district. But check out this poster. I think this is really interesting. This is the poster from 1966, and you'll notice that it's very trippy in the classic sense of But at its heart is an oscilloscope. And what's intriguing to me here is that people who are dropping acid in this period are imagining that they are aligning themselves with the forces of technology, energy, and electricity that are coursing through technological development in Cold War America. But they are transforming it, they imagine, into a new force. They're drawing a lot on Buckminster Fuller here, who has an idea of the comprehensive designer, that your proper role in life is to take the technologies of industrial society and morph them to your own ends. It's very clear, though, that for Brand and for others, they embraced ideas like the expansion of consciousness that were very much of Cold War military research culture. So I think that in the case of Apple in particular, Jobs and Wozniak plugged into a social world that was already imbued with military collaborative styles and some degree of hipness and countercultural collaboration, but that they have since retailed their connections to that world far beyond what those connections actually were. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Becca.
How do you define digital utopianism?
Exactly? Oh, that's a good question. I have to sit down. That's a really good question. Okay.
Because I'm just kind of curious to see how you see it as compared to other forms of utopianism. And,
right.
And then I have some other questions.
Sure, sure. Okay, so that's a really hard question, and I've never been asked it before, so I'm going to wing it.
Really?
I have really never been asked that. No, I have actually never been asked that straight up. But it's an important one. I'll tell you how I define it in terms of this group. I'll take historians' refuge in the data. For this group and for the people who they've inspired, which includes people like Newt Gingrich and Esther Dyson and sort of the very influential 90s people, digital utopianism is the idea that digital technologies networked together will bring about a new social order that will be egalitarian, peer-to-peer, and free of the many social problems brought on by hierarchy and bureaucracy writ large. How's that?
You don't agree with that, right? I'm trying.
Oh, you're trying to find whether I agree with that idea.
First, I'm trying to pin you down on what your definition is, and then I'm trying to get a sense of sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah,
where I stand in relation to that.
Where you stand in relation to that.
So I waffle. And let me waffle in front of you. So that would be my definition. And I think that as a global statement, absolutely not. I think it's absolutely wrong. So I was talking today, for example, with a scholar who's studying journalism in Argentina right now. And he was talking to me about how digital media in Argentina are causing the mainstream newspapers to watch each other very, very closely and to ape each other within minutes. So if they throw up a story about some subject, immediately, within minutes, the other paper has to throw that up. What that's leading to is a tremendous concentration in the kinds of stories told. And those in turn are serving as agenda setters for the bloggers around them. That's a case, I think, and a very powerful case in which the simple existence of digital network technologies is not leading to a more egalitarian world. On the contrary, moreover, we have a problem thinking about how it's not leading to an egalitarian world because we can't think institutions in the language that we've inherited from the new communalists. New institutions are de facto, from the beginning, a problem. So, where they are working, I think, is actually in something like what you're doing. So this is, I mean, I think the Open Voices Initiative is a really interesting potential alternative in which you go to other kinds of societies that are significantly more locked down than ours, arguably, and you give folks a voice and allow them to have some kind of leverage over the social process that's powerful. The question that I would have in that kind of a setting is, what's the articulation between the voice and the institutions to which you're speaking?
Right.
And I'll say one more thing here as a former journalist. I think there's a fiction in journalism, and it's a fiction that's bothered me for a long time. And the fiction is, if you tell them, they will stop.
Yep.
and that's not true. And I know that's not true because I've told them, and they didn't stop. And so this, I think, is one of the fictions that ran in the New Communalist and runs with us now, that speaking is social change. If I simply say something different, the world will change. Well, no.
Right.
It doesn't change.
Exactly.
So does that clarify where I stand on this stuff a little bit?
That totally does, yeah.
Okay.
We could talk more about it later.
Yeah,
I don't want to totally monopolize everything.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Could you go back to what you were elucidating here about how consciousness expansion is mistakenly perceived as having given rise to...
Yeah, I'd love to.
But if without disputing anything you say, which makes a lot of sense, isn't there, a centuries-old tradition of consciousness expansion that, I mean, when you were saying that, I was like, oh, this is exactly what my background's in oral narrative.
Oh, cool.
So it's exactly like when cultures fuse and, well, we're just going to absorb your pantheon and give them new names and maybe a few different jobs, but basically... the gods are still the gods, and it's like, okay, well, we've already got consciousness expansion, and we're going to adapt it to suit our pan-cultural needs.
Right. So, my subject would find your account pretty congenial. I want to narrow the idea. I think that where it doesn't work is when you narrow down the definition of consciousness.
Okay.
Consciousness is a really slippery term, and one of the things that happened in the 40s and 50s, and is something I'm writing more about in other settings, is that. Technical people involved in military research here at the Rad Lab at MIT and then later in the 50s and other settings, were involved in two worlds simultaneously. One, they were involved in these technical worlds where they had to extend our human capabilities in ways to win wars. So they want to extend the body and integrate it well with weapon systems. They want to extend visual, they want to use computers to extend our visual capacity to see over the horizon so as to prevent sudden sneak attack. So in the military world of the everyday job, That's what they're looking at. They're looking at machines for enhancing human capabilities to defend us from attack and save the world. At the same time, in their social worlds, they're entering something quite different. So immediately after World War II, for example, we have to turn around and embrace Japan. Well, when we embrace Japan, we embrace all kinds of Japanese ideals. Zen, for example, which has been a tradition in West Coast poetry preceding the war, but suddenly comes to the fore again in the West. By the 50s, people involved in technical worlds in the West and the East are, in this case, I mean California and Boston, are embracing Eastern ideas. They're starting to read stuff. They're also embracing a very collaborative research style. People often think that the communes emerged only in the 60s. That's sort of true. I spent a lot of time reading Rad Lab oral histories. These were oral histories of the radiation laboratory in World War II at MIT, written largely by the wives of the scientists. Well, it turns out that if you were doing science at MIT in the 40s, you were probably living something close to communally. Because there was a housing shortage during World War II. Scientists were brought in from all over the country to work together, and they began living and working in this very fused, collaborative, networky sort of way. And socially, they got very innovative very quickly. Marriages went all over the place. I mean, it's just wild. You go back and you read that, and so a little old lady is telling you about husband swapping, and you're like, huh? And she's like married to a famous scientist, and you're like, huh?
Yeah,
these books are in your library, so yeah. Okay, just to give you a heads up on this. I mean, it's sort of like astonishing because we tend to think of high science in the mid-century as a lockdown pocket protector world, right? So again, I have a section of a chapter here called "The Forgotten Openness of the Closed World." In my field, this idea of the pocket protector lockdown military world is an idea that's proposed under the thesis that it was a closed world socially, psychologically. And likewise, it wasn't. So what I'm getting at here is that the particular form of consciousness, technology-based consciousness, that Brand and his crew embrace is a fusion of the very technological notion of expanding human capacity for defense purposes with the tradition that you're pointing to of consciousness more largely, sort of almost on more religious lines.
Can I try to gloss it as a difference between expanded physical capacity on the one hand and expanded self-awareness on the other hand?
No. There's this third thing in there. And this is actually the really defining thing about this part of the counterculture. For them, mind and body have started to be indistinguishable categories. Mm. Part of the reason that happens, and this is a long story, so I won't go there, is the bomb itself. Probabilistic physics really changes how people think what matter is, and it changes it in a big way. And the bomb gives examples of how probabilistic physics is actually right, and that freaks everybody out. But more to the point is Brand and his crew fuse the search for technologies that will save the world in the defense sector with the search for their own personal growth. That's where that is. They want to grow up to enjoy the cool small-scale technologies that they've inherited, but not to become the cold warrior, buttoned-down, psychologically locked-away men. They want to do both those things. So the question is, how are they going to do that? When they start dropping acid, that's one of the great thrills, because LSD is a technology that allows you to become more wholly self-aware and to expand your consciousness and to grow and experience and become more adult without becoming a buttoned-down bureaucrat. So there are two accounts of LSD in this book that I think are particularly worth noting. One is Ken Kesey's account, where he talks about losing the nightmare, and he spells it K-N-I-G-H-T-M-A-R-E. And the other is Brand's. He drops it when it's still legal. It's administered by Jim Fadiman, a psychologist in Menlo Park, and he talks about a very similar sort of thing. And you find it interesting, I think. Great. Yeah.
Could you speak some about the transition from in this consciousness and way of relating to technology? It's related to the transformation from ARPANET to internet via PCIP.
Woo. No, because I don't know that they're really connected.
Because it seemed to me that people tend to become less scared of something when they use it.
Okay.
And the first implementation of TCP/IP for PCs, PCIP,
right,
which was developed at MIT around 1984,
right,
allowed people to interact with what had been the exclusive domain of military scientists and academics.
Okay. Let me open that story. Let me take that story a little back in time. I think that makes sense. It strikes me as a sort of another episode in an ongoing story about the opening up of computing. The key figures in that story for me are people like Richard Stallman at MIT, who were the service people around the PDP-10 and other earlier machines. And so the PDP-10 is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, my techno history is not quite as good as my cultural history, but I'll do the best I can with it. If I remember right, the PDP-10 is the first time-sharing computer. It allowed you didn't have to go to the computer people, the computer center, with your stack of Hollow Earth cards. Rather, you could be at a terminal, and you and 15 other users could use it. So it felt like you were using the machine alone. Mm-hmm. That, a lot of my subjects describe that as the moment when they go, oh my God, look what we can do with this. That's the moment when people really, really get involved. And the cast of characters who slightly precede those people, who are users in the sense that we and I would both understand it, are people like Stallman, who are the helpers, the technicians around the machines. There's a wonderful book by Stephen Levy, I really love it, called Hackers, and he describes three generations of hackers. And the first generation are people who work at MIT around large computer systems, but aren't the graduate students, aren't the funded ones. They're the technicians. They're the people who keep the machines running. And they start playing, and they start inventing games, and they start sharing software. And I think that's a really key source of open source culture more broadly, that we tend to read as countercultural, but that actually is technocultural. Yeah.
Can I just pick up on that?
Yeah.
What about Cam Crunch?
Okay.
Cam Crunch appears at a conference in San Francisco, 1984, mm-hmm. sponsored mm-hmm. by Stuart Brand,
yep.
happens to be called the first ever Hackers Conference.
Right.
I was there.
You were there?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. I have the transcripts.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, I have a paper on it, and I have a whole chunk on it in the book here.
So there's a guy called Captain Crunch. His first name is John. I've forgotten his other name. But he goes around hacking phone boxes.
Yep.
Basically, yep. His idea is to give everybody long distance calls at local prices.
Right.
Which in those days is an absolutely revolutionary idea. So what is that? Is this what you're calling technoculture, not counterculture?
Well, let's we have to separate some strands out here. First off, the phone freaking thing. I'll tell you how I read it. I have no pretense to history here. I read it as people with techno lust, people infected with techno lust, attaching themselves to hippie ideals after the ideals are established elsewhere. So the idea that we're going to steal from Ma Bell is an idea that runs through digger culture and then comes later. Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book tells you how to do it. And those things precede Captain Crunch, as I remember it chronologically. So I think that Captain Crunch in particular is somebody who really wanted to do cool stuff with machines and then was able to explain why that thing was cool using a logic that predated him. Okay, so that would be my take on him. The thing that we, I think, need to separate, though, is the figures like Captain Crunch who get invoked to tell a story about machine development in countercultural terms from the actual history of machine development. MIT is far more important to the history of computing and to what we do with computers now than the Homebrew Computer Club was. Okay, I would argue that. But we don't tell that story. And we don't tell that story partly because there are strong marketing forces, Jobs, Wozniak, Apple, promoting alternatives. The Hackers Conference is a moment where these two things get fused. And I think I'll tell that story briefly. This is a classic example of network entrepreneurship by Stuart Brand, and it's an example of the kind of power that I talked about earlier. Stuart Brand, in 1984, meets up with Kevin Kelly, who will go on to become the executive editor of Wired magazine, and they decide, based on reading Stephen Levy's book, to bring three generations of computer workers who have not met each other previously together for a weekend at Fort Cronkite, which is just north of San Francisco. And I actually have a picture from the conference in the book, which I'll show you. It's a picture of Steve Wozniak doing the dishes. Okay, so here they are. That's Woz doing the dishes at the conference. Okay, and he brings together three generations of computer hackers with two other kinds of people. Whole Earth people who are former commune folks, whose communes have all gone away by now. In the early 1980s, the counterculture is dead as dust. Almost all of the communes didn't work, and the ones that did work worked because they had strong religious leanings or strong authoritarian tendencies. They didn't work. So these guys are largely at a loss. I mean, I was the first guy, apart from Brand himself, to read Brand's diaries, and I was allowed to read them up until the last 10 years. In the early 80s and the late 70s, he is a depressed human being. He's looking for stuff to do. So Kelly says, hey, Stephen Levy has this book, Three Generations of Hackers, let's gather them together. He brings them together with countercultural folks and with journalists. And this is the key move. Journalists like John Markoff from the New York Times, Michael Schrag, who I think at that time was working for the Journal, maybe the Post, a few other folks, Fabrice Florin, who's a filmmaker. They get together for a weekend. It's really interesting. And you've been there, so you can actually tell me if this is accurate. I'm working off the transcripts for this. They start telling stories together. You know, hackers in 1984 are people like, you know, who are computer geeks who may threaten to destroy the world. They gather for the weekend, and they start talking. By the end of the weekend, you know, Lee Felsenstein is saying, yeah, we're hackers. We should be proud. We are agents of countercultural change. This is where Stuart Brand utters the famous line, information wants to be free. The second half of that line, not as often quoted, is information wants to be expensive. By the end of the conference, Brand, who has not been involved in computing at this point, is being lauded in the Wall Street Journal, in the Washington Post, and in the New York Times as a founder of the computer revolution. Hackers are being depicted in those same sites as countercultural agents of change. And what's happened here is something that I call in the book legitimacy exchange. The cultural legitimacy of the counterculture and figures like Brand has been exchanged with the emerging technological legitimacy of the people who are involved in the computer industry. And they've both profited. Suddenly, hackers are cool. And in our culture, cool has an enormous financial value. And suddenly, Brand, whose counterculture has faded away, has a new role as a spokesman. He has a new circus. He's a Barnum. And he has a new act. And that's a powerful way to move in the world. And he's done it by gathering these networks together and letting them speak together. So that's how I think we've come to misread some of the history of computing as countercultural through events like that. I wondered a bit. Does that make sense? Does that accord with your recollections?
I think I can tell it personally because I went along there as a general reporter. I didn't have a background in technology.
Were you invited by Brand?
We got wind of what was going on. I was one of the two British reporters in San Francisco at that time. We got wind of what was going on, and we thought it would be fun to go out and see what the hell this was all about.
Yep.
So we didn't style ourselves as technology correspondents, but even people like John Markoff and the people who did were only very recently styled technology correspondents. Technology had only very recently become a story. So we all had a background in general sort of reporting. We didn't have a technical background. So it was natural for us, you know, as journalists, to take this as a starting point. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what you're saying. It's how the story was told from then on.
Right.
But most of us weren't actually hanging around the garage, you know, looking at Wozniak doing his stuff, you know.
And I think this gets to Rebecca's point earlier, too, maybe my response to it. I was always told that what journalists do is go out into the world, find stuff, take it back to some professionalized location, a plant, an office, or whatever, package it up in some professionalized form, and then deliver it out into the world as truth of one kind or another. And that journalistic power is the power to represent. And the classic argument is that some organs, like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, have an especially large power to represent, either because of their authority or their ability to distribute widely. In that story, definitions of the world, the way the world is just sort of out there in the world to be gathered by journalists. But what's interesting to me about the Hackers Conference and about the networked mode of power that I think it represents is that journalists get brought into the process of definition formation. They get recruited right in there. Everybody's new. Nobody has a set story. You're trying to figure it out. The hackers are trying to figure it out. The Whole Earth folks are trying to figure it out. And as you hang out for a weekend together, you start to figure it out together in a language that you share, if only for that weekend. But that's the language that becomes the story in the press. And that, to me, is fascinating. So my core interest in this world is actually not technological. It's how do cultures change? And I think this kind of networked activity is one of the ways that cultures change. It's really important. Yeah?
I have a question about technology. In the political arena. Mm-hmm. When I was in graduate school, I was in a study group at the Kennedy School called Technology and Politics, mm-hmm. and Newt Gingrich was one of the, it was in 1993-94.
Uh-huh. Was he a speaker or a member?
No, he was, I forget the gentleman who had worked for the White House invited him, because they had Paul Wyrick from the Heritage Foundation one week, and Newt Gingrich, and he was talking about a lot of this thing about harnessing the information and getting people out and doing things politically. And it was sort of shocking when the turnover in 94 happened. Everybody walked around, they were stunned. But one of the things that I had to do in the study group was to monitor the libertarian listservs, the Democratic and the Republican, and you can see the flurry of activity and how people were so heavily organized, and they were really, really garnering, you know, just gathering their information about it. It's sort of like seeing history in motion, you know. You know, you don't know what you're going through while you're there until you see the readings. And I saw the professors walking around dazed and confused, like, what happened?
Right.
And I was just curious about I don't think I'm old enough to know if there was something similar, certainly during Vietnam or during Korea. Was there a possible disconnect between people? This was certainly, let's say, the Vietnam War, an obvious case, in terms of people getting organized and extreme disconnect with powers that be that don't understand how much discontent there is and how much people want to change things, or was it just specifically just overt in terms of demonstrations? Or
so my understanding of the Vietnam era is that that the networks that spoke to power about the war did so from the left in fairly organized ways. So SDS formed up in 1962, Students for a Democratic Society, explicitly to do politics to change politics. A lot of those guys had been involved in the civil rights movement one way or another. They had problems by the end of the 60s for a variety of reasons. But most of the anti-war movement was housed and based around campuses and drew on the institutional legitimacy of campuses and the resources of campuses to launch that fight. The anti-war movement was far less effectual than it should have been, and it's painful. And when Kent State happened in 71, it got largely shut down because people got scared they'd get shot. In a very concrete way. They just got scared they'd get shot. And I don't know what to say about that. I wish the anti-war movement had been more effectual than it actually was. That war went on a long time. That war went on 7 years. And, the other thing that happened, though, that I think is pretty interesting, and does anybody have the Whole Earth Catalog? I wanted to say a word or two about the networks. Okay. So the other thing that did happen, though, was that a style of organizing emerged, both in the New Left and the New Communalists, more in the New Communalists. That's really interesting. And it became, I think, a style that we see now around new media. This catalog is interesting for a bunch of reasons. It's interesting because you can't buy any of the items in it. What the catalog shows you is how to get access to the item. You have to then go contact the original person. The catalog items themselves are recommended by readers, mailed in by readers. This is a classic example of sort of user-generated content. And the power of mailing this stuff in for the people who are doing it is not that they're going to make any money, because they only make $10 if it gets accepted. Rather, it's the ability to represent their interests and their communities in this larger organ, where they can then be seen. So what's fascinating is if you're around in the 1960s, before the internet, when telephones are all there is and there's three channels on TV, you buy the Whole Earth Catalog to see the social worlds that it connects. So there are people who write in here from communes all across America. And you can see those communes by looking at the catalog. So that ability to build an alternative world and make it visible is something that emerges in that era. Mm-hmm. But the larger political mode that I think you're describing is not, in my experience. Yeah.
I have too many questions to ask, and I'm not even sure how to ask any of them. Maybe you can help me ask the questions.
I don't know. I'll do my best.
One of them is it closer to the truth that cyberculture saved counterculture, or that
yes,
counterculture defined cyberculture?
That's a great question. Thank you. Cyberculture saved counterculture. The rhythm in my book. I wish I had. Is there a blackboard? There is, but it's off to the side. You know what? Here, I'll go to this, and I'll use something else. Alright. Can you guys more or less see that if I put that there for a sec?
Yeah. Sure.
Anybody have a marker on them?
Some right
Seth, could you grab one from
there? Yeah, just toss me over a marker. I'll work from here. Any old marker will do. Thank you.
Who's Pat?
He's a great
dad. Yeah, he's playing ball over on Flag Street. Alright. You know, the classic story is, I'm just going to use abbreviations, counterculture leads to cyberculture. This is a kind of classic story. And the classic story is there were these machines floating around. The people who made them took LSD. They saw a new vision, and they brought us a new world. Okay, that's sort of the pop story that's out there. And Jobs and Woz and the whole Apple team have been particularly responsible for marketing this story. You remember the famous 1984 ad? Well, maybe you won't. I'm suddenly realizing my age. In 1984, Apple Macs were advertised with a woman in a tracksuit running through a world that looked like Orwellian dark gray mass world. She was the only thing in color. No, I'll save that thought. She smashed the screen where Big Brother was talking, and then it said, Apple. Why 1984 won't be like 1984, the ultimate in liberating machines. Yeah. I should say for purposes of honesty that I was a security guard on the Lisa project at Apple as a 19-year-old and was personally reamed by Steve Jobs. So I'm still working that out. All right.
Put you in good company.
Okay. What's really going on, in my view, is a three-part movement. It's a movement that starts here in World War II with the development of cybernetics, with the development of information technology and information theory, and with the development of collaborative, multimodal, networked research. The research world is just transformed. I can't even tell you how dramatically it was transformed in World War II. Physics is a classic example. In physics in this period, groups that were formerly not connected to one another, instrument makers, theorists, and technologists more broadly, were brought together in places like the Rad Lab or the Manhattan Project to design together for the first time. You have this wild, loose, collaborative world forming up. Yes, the military-industrial hierarchy is still hierarchical, But to get bombs built and technologies developed inside that world, things are very, very loose. Socially, things are very, very loose as well, especially here in Cambridge. This is where the ideology of consciousness expansion comes from. And this is where computing machines come from. The counterculture, the new communalist wing of it in particular, not the new left nearly as much. Todd Gitlin, I should say, founder of SDS, co-founder of SDS, loathes Stuart Brand and loathes the new communalists. The enmity between these two worlds is still very strong. The new communalist wing of the counterculture embraces that idea and I would argue legitimates it culturally in this period. But the counterculture fades away, partly because the new left gets creamed during Vietnam and partly for other reasons having to do with the internal life of the counterculture, like communes don't work very well. By the early 1980s, these machines are still being developed, microcomputers are in place, and particularly in the Bay Area, people who want to be cool turn back toward Brand and the group associated with him. And at places like the Hackers Conference, they embrace one another. I asked Lee Felsenstein in particular. Lee Felsenstein is a famous hacker, was at the Hackers Conference, and was involved in the development of the PC through the Homebrew Club. Why did you want to talk to Stuart Brand in the early 80s? He said, "Are you kidding, Fred?" I said, "No." He said, "Stuart Brand had girlfriends." I mean, it sounds facetious, but it's actually very serious. It's hard to remember now, when computers are so ubiquitous and the people who design them are so cool, that there was a time when they really weren't. When they were not only like the sweaty guys in the back room, but they were potentially world destroyers. Again, another thing not remembered, and it's still there, you can go find this. The AI lab in Tech Square at MIT has a bulletproof wall that was put there to block protesters should they try to take it over. I taught at Sloan for 3 years at MIT. Okay, I taught in the Dewey Library building. My office was on the fourth floor there. If you go up there today, you will see that in the center of the Dewey Library on the fourth floor is a massive, essentially a safe room. It's a bomb-proof safe room for computers. It's not bomb-proof in the sense that, you know, obviously you could drop a bomb on it, but it's there, and they can't put offices in it, they don't know what to do with it. It's there because it was to prevent protesters from getting access to computing machinery. They wanted to keep the machines safe. These were the machines that threatened to destroy the world. So Brand's crew breaks that away and turns technologies toward being world-saving technologies. These guys turn back toward them and re-legitimate the counterculture as we go forward. So that's the movement. But did you want to follow that with a question? That was a great question.
No, I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
So how would you fit in things a little bit more nationally or even locally, like the Boston Computer Society and the FreeNet movement and the community networking movement into all of this?
So that's a really good question to which I don't have a very good answer. And it's, I think, the best challenge to my thesis. I think that there is a legitimately new left side of computing that isn't in my book because I focused on Brand. Mm-hmm. Because I followed Brand through and followed the new communalist story so intensively, I neglected to some degree this other story. And the other story would include the FreeNets, it would include Stallman's work, which is very explicitly political, and which is all about, you know, new not Linux. GNU, is it GNU not Linux or new not Linux?
It's
GNU.
News not Unix.
News not Unix, thank you. Sorry, I got tangled up there. News not Unix, thanks.
But he thinks it's not Linux either, too.
Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah. Thanks. So there's a sort of lefty political tradition that's more of a BBS, FreeNet thing that just isn't in my book, but that I would argue it would be a great subject, you know, for a sort of a left-oriented history of computing. Is there a history of computing that talks not about the turn away from politics, but rather the turn of computing toward politics? That would be really interesting.
A gentleman down at Austin, who you probably ought to talk to if you want
that,
because he's trying to put together a history of the FreeNet movement.
That's really cool. Do you know his name offhand?
I should, because he's a friend of mine. He's interviewed me for it, but
I'm losing it.
But
let's
I'll
talk afterwards and a card and we can connect. That would be great. That would be really, really neat. Yeah, thanks.
I'd like to hear more about your critique of this and kind of the move away from politics and what your thoughts are on that.
So I think I've hit the core points. I mean, I think there's a fiction at large in our era, not just in relation to the internet, but in relation particularly to young people's lives, that's a fiction that's born out of this countercultural turn and its relationship to and celebration of consumer culture. And it's a fiction that says, if I just represent myself, I will change the world. All I got to do is represent. And it's spoken across idioms. It's really interesting to me. It's in hip hop, it's in MySpace, it's in the Gap, it's all over the clothing that my students wear. I mean, we live in an era of intense sort of personal branding, and I think that's just bad.
But you link that back to
I think this stuff is very so I'll say more about that. The commune turn was a turn not only away from politics, but I would argue away from the public sphere and toward the personal. And this is what you were getting at with the self-awareness question. You know, the idea is that if I can make myself sufficiently self-aware, if I can make myself a sufficiently developed person, the world will change around me because I have changed myself. God, is that a narcissistic idea? You know, it's like if I just arrange the mirrors properly, you know, the house will be different. That's nuts. But it's an idea that marketers in the consumer world would love us to believe. It's also interesting in this world, I didn't talk about it yet, but one of the key players in the early Whole Earth scene is Paul Hawken, who co-founded Smith & Hawken, the garden tools company. He also founded the Irwan grocery chain. For folks, and it was his apartment building where everybody crashed after the acid test, and you know. The thing that's interesting about that is that for Hawken and other people like him, founding alternative groceries was the best way to make social change. But when you look at Smith & Hawken, the tool company, you can see, I think, the effects of that. They sell really high-end tools to really rich people who are then free to go to their gardens and feel really in touch with the soil while those around them starve. You know, I mean, this is the rub. So I asked Brand, I said, there's a section, okay, I'm proud of this book. I'm really proud of this book. And I've written a couple of books, but I'm really proud of this one. And I'm proud of a section of this book where I talk about the Whole Earth catalog, and then I turn towards the questions of race and gender at the end of the chapter. Exactly. And so I said to Stuart Brand, why aren't there black people in this catalog? Why aren't there women really in here except naked? And there are naked women in the catalog, and that's really about it.
The spinning wheel.
That's right, spinning wheel and
weren't Dover books with woodcuts of women with clothes on, apparently.
Dang. So I asked about this, and he said, well, you know, I believed at the time, and I still believe now, that the catalog was a technology that we developed that other communities could have used themselves. So the answer is a lot like the NIMBY answer around property. We've got ours. We made ours, and we made a model that others are free to use. So let them use it. But that's a logic I see a lot in the internet too.
Oh, everywhere.
Everywhere. And you know what that explicitly takes out of the conversation is social capital, cultural capital, financial capital, all the stuff that the world actually runs on. That's precisely the most pernicious part of the legacy of the new communalists. Rebecca, did you?
Yeah. Well, kind of coming back to what we were talking about earlier about the extent to which one can assume that just because you have network technologies, you're going to make the world better,
right,
or not. I was wondering if you have any insights about how policymakers, people who are doing ICT for development, you know, people who, even in companies, who are sort of justifying what they're doing because they say, well, we're bringing the internet to X population, so therefore everything we're doing is okay. I think the challenge to cyber utopianism is really important because it grounds in this idea, sure, technologies can be used as tools for change, but these human structures offline, you know, influence profoundly whether or not real change is, and human nature, the limits of human nature, which is one of the problems with utopianism generally. It kind of assumes that whatever it is can change human nature, which is generally incredibly dangerous because the utopians tend to get manipulated by dictators like Mao and Stalin, and millions of people get killed. I was just wondering, what what types of conversations, research, policy prescriptions do you think are necessary? And I know ONI is doing some really good work looking at around the world how, you know, the limits of of what the internet can do to change societies, because governments are imposing those limits. And so you know, I guess another example being Microsoft, Yahoo, and Google. They go into China,
let's go to China.
They comply with Chinese government censorship requirements.
Lots of people there, yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of attention over there.
And then they get called into Congress, and Congress is like, you bad people, you're helping censor the internet in China, and Yahoo, you're especially bad because you're helping the Chinese government put people in jail.
Yeah.
And the response is... But that doesn't really matter because we've brought the internet to China, and therefore, you know, and the same argument gets made with any, you know, n number of non, you know, of countries run by dictators.
So as long as
we brought the internet, that you know, yeah, there might be some bad things done with our technology, or we might even be complicit in some of those bad things being done, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, because at the end of the day, we've brought this essence of democracy that's going to just change everything.
So the key words, I think, is the word essence of democracy, and I want to answer your question. I know people have other things to do in lives, so I think we'll try to wrap formally by 1:30, which I understand is close, but I'm happy to stay in chat or do whatever. But we will wrap by 1:30. The thing that happened in the 90s, and to some degree a little earlier, but especially in the 90s, was that the internet got depicted as what I call a rhetorical prototype. It became a technology, and that's in the book, that prototyped a social order. And the social order was democratic, libertarian, and market-based. And information and money and democratic opinion all seem to be the same thing. If you just get them in circulation, the world changes. That's hooey.
Yeah.
But it's particularly American hooey.
Right.
The proper reference point for this is The Quiet American by Graham Greene, who goes to Vietnam with the hope of doing precisely this.
Yeah.
So what's the alternative to The Quiet American? Well, sometimes I'm thinking it might be to wire the White House and make them less ignorant. But with more seriousness, I think some of the things that need to be done are already being done. I think you guys are doing them, actually. That's one reason I'm excited to be here. Let me see if I can do the broad question. The key word, I think, across the board is institutions. The world runs in institutions. It doesn't run in individuals, though we'd like to think that it runs in individuals in our narcissistic way. The marketing world runs in individuals. I buy my things, I can put together my image, I can build myself. I'm watching my daughter now, I have an 11-year-old daughter. Well, I'm watching her train herself in how to put together her look. She goes on to Yahoo and plays with her avatar for her email system for like a half an hour. She's building her look, you know? And for her, that's liberating. And okay, fine. But institutions are where material power is concentrated. Institutions are the places that can deploy the National Guard to shoot the protesters and shut them right up. Institutions are who can send our troops abroad. Institutions are who control our funding. Okay, so there's two approaches to this and to the networks that are the network, that are the internet. One approach is to, I think really hard about how you can link processes of representation to institutions. And I think the internet offers a way to do that that's different than newspapers ever did. In the newspaper era, newspapers told the truth about the world, and reporters went to parties with politicians. Mm-hmm. and the politicians were embarrassed in front of their families or their wives or whoever because the story was out in the paper. And that social world had some real leverage, I think, over politics. In the internet era, it's maybe possible to do different kinds of things. I'm especially interested in seeing how the networks that form on the internet can be either institutionalized or semi-institutionalized. Beth Novick at NYU is doing some really interesting work around this. I think that's really interesting. If networks are to have power, then they need to be able to control resources in some way that seems something like institutions do now. I'm not saying they need to be brick and mortar forever and forever, but there have to be some kind of mechanisms for organizing the activity there. A meetup is one. So if you think of a spectrum of possible mechanisms for institution networks, a meetup is on one end. We represent ourselves to each other in cyberspace, and then we meet up for some action in real space. And maybe it's a one-time thing, and that's fine. Maybe the other spectrum is we represent to each other in cyberspace, and we begin to organize in ways that allow us to own property together, to ship goods together, to make interventions in other material spaces. Now, that gets complicated. If, for example, your network is distributed around the globe, yet you want to act within one national sphere that is geographically based, that's a challenging thing. But arguably, there are models for that all through the NGO world, you know, that are really interesting. So if you think of that as a spectrum, so the one broad challenge is how do we acquire institutional privileges and structures for networks that are built online? That's one question. The other question would be, how do we take the networks and the forms of representation that are there and deploy them against, in response to, in relation to existing institutions? I don't have any models for that that aren't things that you guys are already trying. I really don't know how to do that. All I do is the classic academic thing. I go back to my classroom and I scream, representation isn't change.
Right.
You know, and I end my history in 1998.
Right.
You know, and I sort of point to a bunch of things. And I haven't got an answer for that. I mean, you probably had this when you were reporting. And, you know, at the end of every critique story, you were supposed to sort of throw in three instructions for change. You know, like, I've made this really negative critique of the world, and now here's how you make it better. Mm-hmm. I always had trouble with that, here's how you make it better part. I was always much better at the sort of critique part. So now I go book length with the critique, it's okay. but does that help a little?
Yeah. No, it absolutely does. And that's really where the rubber hits the road. It's
right.
Not just the existence of the internet and the ability of people to talk, but to what extent, you know, that where talking
right.
really meets up with action
right.
and institutional change. And in places like China, the reason why, you know, there's so many assumptions that one gets made. You know, they're journalists saying all the time, oh, the internet will bring down the Chinese Communist Party. And
we
started doing stories about that in the mid 90s. And you know,
right.
But exactly one of the reasons why maybe there's a lot of cultural change happening that in the very long term, which is, I'm interested in having a longer conversation
yeah.
about the culture side, but politically it goes nowhere, is because the government has very effectively shut off any ability of that representation, that conversation, to jump into institutional
right.
real yeah. action.
And there's a nice analogy here in Vietnam. You know, the Vietnam anti-war movement had some effect. I don't mean to deny that for a minute. But it had effect only after journalistic institutions met up with law systems 68 and later. We tend to think of journalists during Vietnam as very anti-war. That wasn't the case. With a couple of rare exceptions, they were actually very pro-war. I mean, I have quotes, you know, the New York Post, God, 1966 says, you know, has a headline, wagon train GIs drive off red men. I mean, that's the New York Post. That's how we were imagining that war, okay? Toward the end of the war, you know, particularly when Walter Cronkite sees Tet in 1968 and says, you know, we're losing this war despite what Westmoreland says, that's when things start to turn. What got Nixon out of office wasn't the protests in the street, which by that time had stopped largely. It was Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post, a large institution with the funds and the ethos and the styles that were available to leverage an attack on government that could be sustained over time, and to take the risks that are associated with that. And then finally there was a system of law that was allowed to be applied to Richard Nixon. He said, this is the law and you broke it. You can't do this. You have to have all of those things in place, law, institution, and actors within those things to make this make change happen. Just being out in the street, being the yippies and running a pig for president in 68 doesn't change stuff. It just lets you buy more cool clothes. I think, did you have a question earlier? I thought, no, yes, no, you really, yeah. Yes.
No, but I'm actually interested because I grew up in San Jose.
Okay, yay.
What you noticed about like the changing demographics of the Bay Area in colliding with this counterculture, cyberculture movement
yeah.
In the past like 20 to 25 years, and
yeah.
if it's a story of like in terms of race and gender exclusion or mutual exclusivity, or
yeah.
if there is some, you know, dialogue or interchange.
Sure. So it's a great question, and I think about this a lot. I have a little project where I go around with cameras and I take pictures of the different styles of mobility in the valley, and they're very, very different. One style of mobility is high-end rich people tech culture mobility, where you come from one of about four schools, MIT, RPI, The big one in Texas, it's just not coming to me right now. These are big engineering schools, and you come out and you work there. And the other is, at the other end, the tremendous number of undocumented Mexican immigrants who live in little trailer parks tucked behind gas stations in these very rich towns. And it blows me away. I mean, I started finding these. I've gotten lost a couple times looking for the mall, and I find these trailer parks, and it's like Appalachia in Mountain View, which is the town I live in. So those things are going on. The countercultural piece, I think, appeals most to college-educated people between 25 and 35 who migrate in, usually from very high-end schools, concentrate in San Francisco, or are forced by employment to be in the Valley. And they buy into that stuff more. It's all over Google. I've been writing about Google and Burning Man lately. It's all over there. I mean, it's the folks who go to Burning Man. Anybody here been to Burning Man? So on the East Coast. This is so interesting.
Are you talking about Burning Man?
Anytime. I mean, anytime between then and now, I'll take any Burning Man experience. Do they have it on New Jersey now? That'd be great. I wonder what they burned in New Jersey. That would be really good. You know, like, can you imagine a comic?
Rivers.
Exactly. The Sopranos meets Burning Man. You know? That's great. So there's that whole Burning Man world. So I went to Burning Man this year, and it was all white. You know, it was almost exclusively white, very wealthy, very, again, narcissistic. You know, I'm going to change myself and change the world. You know? So that's culturally still there. Execs at that level play in that world quite a bit. And young people try to get into it via San Francisco especially. Meantime, worker mobility is still really high. On the low end, it's still really a miserable life. Racism is endemic, but it's unspeakable.
Yeah.
You don't call people names, you just say they're not cool. Mm-hmm. You know, Mexicans aren't cool, but they sure do work hard. You see where I'm going with this?
They don't have iPods or something.
So pardon?
They don't have iPods or something.
Yeah, they don't have iPods, and you know, they're just, it's like, so the last chapter of my book is called The Triumph of the Network Mode. And this is what bothers me about the network mode of doing power. Is that if you do power in networks, you organize networks by culture, by likeness, by similarity to yourself. And other people, you get to solve the classic American racial problem. You don't have to say, I'm a racist. You just don't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, let them form their own network. Yeah. What's the problem with that? Technology's open to everyone. You know, or you can do, as they say at Burning Man, you can say, we're open to everyone. Everyone can come here. It's an open place, but what's weird about it is everybody plays techno music, so if you're not culturally open to that very uniform cultural style, you don't fit, and that's the rub. So there's a lot of folks in the Valley who still don't fit, and this legacy, I think, hides that not fitting, and facilitates the abuse of workers at many levels, including the senior levels. I mean, I think that working for a lot of information firms right now is a very tenuous, nervous business. And people adopt ideas from the counterculture. I'm cool, I'm flexible, I'm mobile, I'm a nomad, to help rationalize increasingly disconnected lives.
We used to call Brand and the Well people the Deadhead Ghetto.
Deadhead Ghetto, yes. Yeah, well, it's interesting about the Well. I've gone back through their archives as well, which are online, though a number of them have been pulled off for reasons that are obscure to me. In the Well in the late 80s, people speak a very New Agey language, and there are people who write in to conferences and say, you guys aren't talking to me. And finally, there's one doctor in particular who did this, and I think Howard Rheingold wrote back and says, because you don't talk like us. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, that's really interesting. So, yeah.
I have a poorly formed question.
Good. Best kind. Parenthetically, it's so funny to talk about this book. I mean, I spent like 3 years alone in a back room at Sloan reading Whole Earth catalogs thinking I've lost my mind. All my colleagues were studying the internet. I've left journalism. I'm going to be unemployed. All my colleagues are studying the internet, and I want to read the Whole Earth catalog. I'm nuts. So when you talk about poorly formed questions, I'm like, I lived it for years. Please. Okay.
I grew up during the 50s and 60s, and a lot of pieces of your story resonate.
Great.
My father was in World War II, and he was a musician, but when he came out, he was so excited about television as a new technology and how it could change the world.
Yeah, right.
He was a television director, and at some point he was doing an investigative piece on psychotropic drugs, and he was going to take LSD. He was advised not to, but...
Did he in the end?
He didn't, but...
Are you sure?
Well...
I have to decide what to tell my daughter about my own experience. Yeah, it's very interesting. I don't know.
So, and I, for a short time, was involved in communal living.
Where?
War protesting in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Great, yay.
And I found the communal living oppressive intellectually and socially, and
yeah.
I found war protesting really scary. I had roommates who were peace activists who talked a lot about killing people.
Yeah.
you know, what I found, so what those experiences did for me was push me, you know, towards a lifelong interest in how cultures change and how to change cultures, but also in what is effective political action,
right.
Especially towards issues of social justice. And it's, you know, I guess a lot of what I'm saying is echoing what you're saying, that I find it ironic at my age that there are so many people my age who have this romantic identification with the 60s, with activities that they weren't involved in. And also that it seems like so many political efforts now towards social justice embrace a kind of romantic identification with aspects of the 60s that are really about identity and aren't about effectiveness. And so, you know, the question I have, you know, as I was thinking, you know, I think we've hobbled so many political processes by focusing them around issues of identity.
God, that's great. You're so right.
And not towards real problem solving. You know, so you're with us or against us, not how can we get to a solution. So you've talked about this need for knowledge and processes and structures that you build. You know, the technology is just a tool. I mean, it becomes a tool that becomes part of an identity, too. But how do we get there, and what are the next steps? I'm still working on that myself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really a substance of my work. So, working with communities is like moving beyond that who we are to what are the issues we're facing and how can we get around that. And I did see some incredible successes in the communities that I worked in, but it meant a lot of face-to-face work. And it meant building new reservoirs of knowledge in the community and having access to
it. I think it means something really basic that you're pointing to, which is turning outward. Not what do I need, but what does she need? Who is he? What do they need? Yeah. And that's very hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm unfortunately a bad example for this. I'm the guy who goes around taking pictures of the trailer parks, but have I knocked on any doors in there lately? You know, and actually my family and I are actually going to start, we're actually part of a project that will start in a couple of weeks, but that's after 4 years in the valley. It's very hard to get outside your world, but asking what others need is absolutely key. I think that's really, I think there's a couple of fictions that are left over partly from the 60s and partly from, partly ironically, I don't know if it's from civil rights or from more from the era of the 70s and 80s, sort of the politics in the streets stuff. If you're not us, you can't understand us, is one of the most pernicious ideas that's out there. If you're not like us, you can't understand us. That's just awful. You know, and it's part of a power claim that emerged in the 60s, 70s, and 80s around identity. So I love ACT UP. You know, ACT UP is one of my favorite organizations. You know, we're queer, we're here, get used to it. Great. That's great. But how do I, as a straight, square, Brooks Brothers shopping white guy, enter into a dialogue with that says, I understand some of what, I feel some of what you're doing. And if the claim to power in ACT UP, for example, is built around displays of sexual style that culturally I'm blocked off from. So this is part of at this point, to another issue that I think is really important. If culture is the ground for political action, you're stuck. You're stuck around this identity problem.
Yeah.
You have to shift so that culture is in play, but the ground for action is institutions. The ground for action speaks to a notion of humanness that is transcultural. Now, there are risks in this, too, when you do things like go to Iraq because they're people like us and they need democracy just the way we do. So there are risks, obviously, to ignoring culture and to sort of having a trans-historical, trans-national ideal. Now, this, again, is the quiet American problem. You know, everybody wants what I want because I'm everybody. That's the fallacy there. But at the same time, I think we've pushed very hard against that fallacy. We need to turn back to, you know, what do you want? Talk to people. Ask people. One of the great lessons of journalism for me was that if I ask people questions, they'll tell me things. Anybody. I mean, I have yet, I mean, other than Nicholas Negroponte, I have found no one who would not talk to me. He would not talk to me. But no one else would not talk to me in all of my years.
And Steve Jobs?
Yeah, even Steve Jobs would talk to me in a special way. Very special way. It was great, too. I got a call later from his assistant. They were trying to hire a new assistant. They wanted to hire a Stanford student, and they called me to see if I knew any. I just loved that. That was one of those life's ironies. It's like, I'm going to send someone to the maw of that job. I don't think so. But does that help a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... it's an ongoing challenge to shift
big
the conversation.
Challenge. It's a really big challenge. It's a really big challenge. And I think, so I'm going to ramp one more time. Media, most broadly, have exposed us to styles of life and ways of being at an enormously diverse level over the last 100 years in ways that are hard to fathom. I've been reading a lot in the 19th century lately, and people are just, their jaws are on the ground all the time. That's resulted in a real diffusion of moral standards. This is where I think the new right comes in. I'm an atheist. I'm a non-Republican in every way, but I really sympathize with the evangelical call to moral order and moral structure, and I think I can see where that's coming from a little bit. And so the question is, if we're going to be secular, if we're going to be diverse, can we organize moral claims and social action around things other than the preservation of the self? How do you make moral claims without a theology or a rigorous intellectual framework for doing that? I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that the lack of a general answer to that question is part of the roots of the power of things like evangelism in different places. Yeah.
It's fine, you got it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Well, we used to talk about the common good.
Oh, I'm in Cambridge again, it's true. Sorry, yeah, we stopped that out west. Yeah, but the common, that's great, and the common good is important. That's right, and also I think it's important to articulate the many different kinds of people that belong on the commons with us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's really, really important, and this is one of my rubs with some commons-oriented discourse around the internet. The cultural commons that people want to create sometimes seems like it has no. I don't hear a language for let's bring in a whole lot of really different kinds of people.
Yeah.
Let's bring in different kinds of cool cultural artifacts and mash them up. Okay. But, so, yeah.
Your topic was very, very interesting. I think a book that could complement your argument is called The Postmodern Condition,
uh-huh.
Lyotard from France.
Yeah.
It's basically, he presents how that historical argument that how institutions fall, but at the same time, and how the paradigms change. Because right. In the 60s, it used to be more something about identity and like more like a collectiveness outside of the street.
Yeah.
Right now, it turns more like instead of being in America, it turns international.
Yeah.
So it's how things work in
right.
that sense.
Yeah, no, it's
that,
a wonderful book. Actually, no, yeah, I know the book. And it's a really important one. The postmodern critiques have opened up a lot of this question for us. I think they are impoverished when they come to talking about institutions, and that's part of the challenge. We've gone past our time, and so I do want to stop now. I'm very happy to stay and chat. Thank you so much for a really interesting conversation. I'm so really lucky to be here. Thank you.